On this edition, we're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Diet for a New America with best-selling author John Robbins. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. Originally published in 1987, Diet for a New America awakened the conscience of a nation with its startling examination of the food we buy and eat and the moral, economic, and medical price we pay for it. Drawing a clear line connecting America's factory farm system with disease, animal cruelty, and ecological crises, Robbins makes perhaps the most eloquent argument for vegetarianism ever published. John Robbins walked away from his family's business, the Baskin-Robbins ice cream empire, to pursue his dream of promoting a healthy society that practices compassionate stewardship of a balanced ecosystem. In Diet for a New America, he presents both a disturbing portrait of our current system and a vision for the future that will educate and empower readers to change. Activist and author John Robbins is considered by many to be one of the world's most eloquent spokespersons for a sane, ethical, and sustainable future. His work has been featured in all major print and broadcast media. He lives with his family near Santa Cruz, California, and it's from the beautiful Santa Cruz area that he joins us today. John Robbins, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
You know, I enjoyed reading your book many years ago. In fact, it changed my life. You probably have heard that a lot. One of the things that I was reminded of as I reread this anniversary edition is the powerful stories you tell about animals demonstrating their incredible intelligence. And one of the things we've been led to believe, I think, as a culture, John, is that animals are without intelligence. And of course, part of this is so we can justify eating them and raising them in an inhumane way. Reading your stories is powerful because each one demonstrates, I think, the undeniable intelligence and kindness of animals. You have a lot of them in that very first chapter, All God's Critters Have a Place in the Choir. I just love the title chapter, I think. Can you share a short story out of that chapter, do you think, for our listeners to illustrate this?
Well, there are many. I think most of our listeners probably have stories of their own. I've asked people, have you ever known an animal in your life, a non-human animal, that has enriched you, that where that relationship has made you more human, given something to your heart that's important to you? And most people say yes. Maybe they think of companion animals they've known and loved who've been part of their families, dogs or cats. Maybe they think of wild animals that have touched them very powerfully in their souls. Our relationships to animals can be among the most meaningful experiences in our lives.
Yeah.
We don't often recognize that fully, and I think part of the reason, as you said, is because by staying in denial about that, it allows us to treat animals very cruelly that we then eat. We actually have a schizoid relationship to animals in a way, in that on the one hand, we treat our dogs and cats pretty well. We give them names, we pay their vet bills, we buy their food. Many times they sleep with us on our beds. They're part of our families.
Mm-hmm.
We love them, and our lives are strengthened and enriched because of those relationships.
Absolutely.
And I think that's beautiful.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
But on the other hand, at the same time, we make a semantic distinction. We call those animals pets, and other animals we call dinner, or we call them livestock, and we feel entitled, by virtue of that semantic distinction, to treat those other animals with any manner of cruelty as long as it lowers the price per pound.
Mm.
We do have laws, all 50 states have legislation that prohibits cruelty to animals, but the telling thing is that all 50 states exempt animals destined for human consumption from that legislation. So in other words, you can do things, and the industry routinely does, to cows, to pigs, to chickens, to turkeys, that if you did them to a dog or cat, you'd be put in jail for a felony. But their standard operating procedure in modern meat production.
When I first read your book, I was so unaware of the statistics and everything that we're going to be talking about now and that you've been talking about most of your life. And it did make a profound difference in my life, and I know it has for many of my friends. I was reminded as I reread the introduction, one of the things you wrote was, "Millions upon millions of Americans are merrily eating away, unaware of the pain and disease they're taking into their bodies with every bite. We are ingesting nightmares for breakfast, lunch, and dinner," something you're not going to see Madison Avenue put out in commercials.
No, they put out fraudulent commercials of happy cows. There's a big ad campaign currently coming from the California Milk Producers Association nationwide saying that, great cheese comes from happy cows and happy cows come from California. it's a lovely fantasy, but even the ads are phony. You know, those the photographs in the ads, the video in the ads, is actually taken in Auckland, New Zealand.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, because California's dairies are, in fact, mainly located in the Central Valley, in particular the San Joaquin Valley, which is very dry. It's really arid, and, these animals never see a blade of grass. They're in dry feedlots on dirt. They're crammed together in extremely unnatural conditions. They're not happy at all. To call them happy is grotesque. And, you know, there's a movement afoot in this country. People mm-hmm. will pay more for organic food. Mm-hmm. They will pay more for humanely raised products, grass-fed beef or free-range eggs or that kind of thing. But if you lie about that, if you sold apples as organic that were not, that were sprayed with pesticides, that would be illegal. Mm-hmm. And if you advertised them as organic when they were not, that would be called false advertising.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have the same kind of scrutiny over claims like free-range or naturally raised or humanely raised. So there's no third-party certification. There's no actual validity or teeth to those labels. So what you have is the California Milk Producers, for example, claiming that that this cheese that they sell and the other dairy products that they market are from happy cows when they aren't, which takes advantage of people's desire that, and it's a beautiful desire, that the livestock involved in our meat and dairy production should be treated with respect, should have decent lives, should eat food that is natural to their biology, but in fact they aren't, and yet we don't call them for false advertising. We don't say that that's illegal. We let them get away with it. I actually think we shouldn't, and I think we should put a stop to false advertising like that exploits people's compassion.
Yes, I would agree with that. And, you know, I'm currently reading another book of yours, and I found myself in the last 2 weeks going back and forth into this 25th anniversary book and this book, Healthy at 100, that you wrote several years ago. And I see the connection to be even healthy as we grow older, because as you said in that book, I think you called it an age wave. In terms of the boomers that are going, 80 million boomers. But hence, again, the need for this diet for a new America.
Well, I'm 65. I'm eligible for Medicare. And I am still a marathon runner and a triathlete. I feel great. And, you know, the plural of anecdote is data.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one person, but I've also heard from thousands of others who have eaten plant-strong diets, who've eaten natural foods, who've eaten wholesome foods, gotten away from the highly processed, toxic food environment that we call normal in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And what's happened, if they've done that for over a period of time, is their bodies start to vibrate differently. They start to radiate differently. They start to be healthier and become vibrant expressions of their spirits and vehicles for their lives, instead of being, as you get older, burdened and afflicted and chronically ill. What we're seeing as people get older in our society, we're seeing people living longer, but they're not living, the health span is not increasing.
Yeah.
The lifespan is, but they're spending more time sick, more time on drugs, more time in hospitals, spending more money, often bankrupting their families on medical expenses that, in fact, would be prevented if they had earlier switched healthy plant, strong diet.
It's a joy to have on today's program activist and best-selling author John Robbins. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of his groundbreaking book, Diet for a New America. I'm Richard Brendan. We'll have much more after a short break. Welcome back to the program. It's an honor to have John Robbins on today's program. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of his book, Diet for a New America. John, I'd like to talk about chickens because chickens get a bum rap. And you talk about that so eloquently in your book. There's a chapter called Brave New Chicken. In the beginning of this chapter, you talk about how our culture uses the word chicken to describe a coward. You say, chickens, while high-strung and quick to startle, are anything but gutless, timid creatures. Roosters are renowned for their pride and ferocity and the adamant assertion of their power. You go on to say female hens are likewise not the craven creatures we've been conditioned to think they are. They can be absolutely fierce in defending their little ones, even against terrible odds and much larger predatory birds. Yet, as you say, the raising of chickens in the United States today is not, however, a process that overflows for compassion for these animals. I think most people would be astounded, as I was, to know how industrialized and inhumane this practice has become. Can you talk about the chicken industry today and briefly describe its practices?
Yes, Richard, thank you. And I want to say, too, that the Romans actually had a phrase, son of a hen, which they used to describe a man who had been fortunately raised, whose mother was very nurturing and compassionate and present for him. They would call such a man son of a hen because they were closer to these birds than we are, and they knew their natures, and they saw how loving they are and caring they are to their young. So, but in our chicken factories today, our hens never see their young. They're crammed into cages so small they can not lift a single wing. I mean, they're rubbing up against each other all the time. In fact, this is called stocking density. That's the term that's used by agribusiness, and the stocking densities are so high that These birds they look like walking wounds more than birds. Their feathers are rubbed off. They're covered with sores, because they have no room to move at all. That's how tightly crammed into these cages they are. It's horrible, and anybody who has any compassion for birds likes to see them winging in the sky. Mm-hmm. When you see birds in a tree and hear their song, if it lifts your heart a little bit or brightens your day a little bit, that's a connection to nature and to the natural world that birds can give us. Birds are part of life here on this earth in ways that and play roles in the healthy functioning of our ecosystems that we're just beginning to understand. They are our brethren. They are part of the earth community. And yet what we've done is we've taken some of these birds and we've bred them for meat production, for chicken, for broilers, or for egg laying, and then we treat them abominably. We treat them with no respect for the fact that they're living creatures. It's not that the agribusiness cartels that run these operations are trying to be cruel. They are trying to make money. They are trying to cut costs. And it just so happens that the practices that they employ in order to cut costs often, and in fact predictably, end up being cruel to the creatures, to the chickens. The degree of it is so severe. You don't have to be a vegetarian. You don't have to be an animal rights proponent.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you don't even have to be a particularly empathic human being. If you see it, to be appalled and to find it deplorable and to want to object to it because it's so extreme.
Yeah.
But the industry doesn't want people to see it. They keep the veil in place. They want the curtain closed. They want us unaware. And in fact, they have passed legislation called ag gag bills that prohibit and make it illegal to take video footage or photography of slaughterhouses and factory farms and provide that information of what's going on behind these closed doors to the public. Actually, I think it's a public service to provide that information to the public. I think people have a right to know how their food is produced and where it comes from.
Absolutely.
And I think that right should be protected. But in fact, agribusiness, and in particular the feedlot and factory farm industries, are hell-bent on prohibiting us from being conscious of how our meat products and our dairy products are produced.
Mm. The word you used, conscious, is a big word because really at the root of everything that we're going to be talking about today is either a lack of conscience or something else that I prefer to use a lot came from Schweitzer, and that's there's a lack of reverence for life.
Yes, I love that phrase of Albert Schweitzer's, reverence for life. It implies something that we don't have a lot of in our society today. We don't live with respect for ourselves and each other. We live with a kind of acquisitiveness. We want to, you know what I think the sickness is really. We're taught to we're taught to use people and to love things, and I think the truth of ourselves is found when we use things and love people.
I would so agree with that. And I've seen that bore out not only in situations dealing with animals, I've seen it how we treat our elderly these days.
Absolutely. And it's one of a kind, because if we treat animals with disrespect, with cruelty, very often we treat other people that way as well.
Yes.
You know, there are so many ways that this is connected. People will often say to me, well, I understand that the animals, that livestock are poorly treated, but I don't have room in my life to care for that. I have compassion fatigue, and I need to care for people, and I need to care for my own health. I just don't have space for it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they turn their backs. And I say, well, here's the reality of it. In modern meat production, we do treat animals with tremendous cruelty. And the result of that is these animals are stressed beyond belief. And they would die from the stress and the illness that they experience, but they don't because they're infused with drugs. Antibiotics are mixed into every meal they eat. They're injected with hormones. There's a whole a plethora of drugs, pharmaceutical agents that are used to support modern factory farming. Without those drugs, it would collapse. And then residues from those drugs end up in the meats and dairy products and eggs we then eat.
Mm-hmm.
And our antibiotics, our medical weapons, are losing efficacy because we're breeding antibiotic-resistant bacteria through the use of antibiotics in our factory farms. So the more cruelly we treat the animals, the more polluted and contaminated are the meat, dairy, and egg products to our health. And then our bodies then bear the product of that misery.
And that's why you write, we're ingesting nightmares for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and we're not even aware of it.
It's true, and I think that that most people, if they were aware of it, they'd object. They wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah.
They really wouldn't. And that's one of the reasons the industry knows this, too, I think. And that's why they're so intent on passing these ag gag bills and suing Oprah Winfrey, for example, when she had a show about mad cow disease.
Oh, yeah.
They just don't want the truth known.
Mm. Hmm. It's a joy to have John Robbins on today's program. He's an activist and best-selling author. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of his groundbreaking book, Diet for a New America. We will have more of the conversation right after a word from our sponsor.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. It's such an honor to have John Robbins on today. He's an activist, best-selling author. We're talking about his book, Diet for a New America, now the 25th anniversary edition. Hard to believe it's been out for 25 years, John. And we talked in the first segment about really the disrespect and lack of understanding we have for such a beautiful creature, and that's a chicken. Well, how about the pig? It's clear that we discount the pig in so many ways. And after reading your chapter about this sad state of affairs, my heart hurt. In talking about the hidden truth about pigs, you write, "To call a man a pig or a woman a sow is one of the worst insults in our common speech. And this fact testifies not to the nature of pigs, but to our beliefs about them, and only shows how far out of touch we are with these animals. The commonly held image of pigs as greedy, fat, and filthy creatures, gross beasts who eat anything that isn't fastened down, and who selfishly indulge their basest instincts without a trace of sensitivity, could hardly be further from the truth. You tell us in this chapter, pigs actually have one of the highest measured IQs of all animals, surpassing even the dogs. They're friendly, sociable, fun-loving beings as well. Now, you tell the story about Hudson's pig to illustrate how pigs can remember individuals clearly and even appreciate human contact when it's not hostile. Can you share that story for our listeners and also just enlighten, for people who are totally unaware of what you've been writing in your book, the truth about the pig and the beauty of that creature?
Well, yes. Many of us don't realize what kind of animals pigs are, and I sometimes hear somebody, you know, call a human being a pig, and I think it's kind of unfair to the pig, frankly. Because you know, there are farm sanctuaries now all over the country. Mm-hmm. These are places where farmed animals, animals that have been rescued from factory farms and slaughterhouses, are given decent lives, and where people can visit and get to know these animals. And invariably what happens, I've been to many of these places, and always what you see is children giving pigs belly rubs, laying down with pigs. Pigs love to lie with each other and with people when they're treated well. I'm not talking about an animal that has been harmed or been injured or been assaulted. Of course, they're going to react defensively and try to protect themselves. But when pigs are treated well, they become very friendly to people and very safe for children. And children have this tremendous delight. And the pig kind of snorts back, you know, the oinking sound that they make, and they offer their neck to be scratched, and they are friendly creatures. They're not docile creatures. They're energetic, and they're not subordinate the way dogs are. I love dogs, but dogs have a way of placing us above them. They want to please us. They want to cooperate with us. That's their nature. Cats, on the other hand, probably could care less, but they have their own way of loving us. Pigs are in the middle. They're horizontal with us. They're straight across. Yeah. They meet us as equals, and they are every bit as intelligent as dogs. They can learn our names. They learn words, not that they can speak, but they learn what we mean by words. They learn to they make distinctions between who individuals and the family. They learn our habits. They appreciate when we feed them, of course. But they aren't obsessed with it. They're much more playful and gregarious than most people could ever imagine. And the fact of this, the fact of who pigs actually are, makes the way we treat them in pork production facilities all the more obscene.
Hmm. Where do you think we get the image of how we use, though, the pig, such as a man's a pig or a woman's a sow? Where did that come from?
Well, I think it originated to push these animals away.
Mm-hmm.
To go into denial about their natures makes it easier to eat them. And you know, I think our desire for pork and for bacon underlies our contempt for these animals. But that contempt says something about us. It does not say anything about them.
Yeah, yeah. In your chapter about cows, you say the truth is that cows have a special kind of intelligence and sensitivity. But because they're such patient and gentle souls, and boy, by the way, can't you see that when you look them in their eyes? Gentle souls who rarely hurry or make a fuss about things, we tend to think they're dumb and don't recognize their unique presence. Rooted deeply in the rhythms of the earth, they move through life with a peacefulness that is not easy to disturb. They're not troubled by much of what bothers us, and when they are alarmed, usually by things we can't see, they're slow to panic and rarely overreact. Wouldn't it be great if we could have the patience of a cow?
Wouldn't it? And I think we are obviously a very driven society. We're time stressed.
Yeah.
We're always in a hurry. We're trying to get somewhere we're not. We're, you know, this is the nature of life in our culture.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting how healing the presence of a cow can be to us, because that is our wound.
Yeah.
That is where we are hurting. That's where we're vulnerable. And the cow actually is strong and has this gift of deep peace and connection to the earth and a slower rhythm and a quietness about their nature if they're treated well.
Yeah.
But do you know, there are dairies today that actually give cows tranquilizers to calm them down because they are so agitated under the conditions they're kept that their milk production is impaired. They're actually treated with so much contempt and disrespect, and that to speak of reverence for life is just ridiculous, or happy cows is just absurd. The level of disregard for their needs, the level of violation of their instincts and their basic requirements as animals, is so universal in modern dairy farming, modern factory farming of cows. For those of us who have known cows, it's really an abomination to see how they're treated today.
You refer to that, I think, as the pharmaceutical farm.
Yes, because of the amount of drugs.
Mm-hmm.
It's really ugly. You know, the United States is the only industrialized country in the world today to allow, for example, genetically engineered bovine growth hormone.
Yeah.
To be injected into our dairy cows.
Yeah.
The European community won't allow it. Japan won't allow it. Nobody else will, really. And yet we do it. Our large dairies do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it does increase milk production, but it does so. The poor creatures, their udders get huge. They almost drag on the ground, and they predictably become infected with a disease called mastitis. It's an udder infection that produces a lot of extra pus in the milk. And and so Monsanto, when they deliver the growth hormone to the dairies, along with it, packaged with it, comes the antibiotics used to treat the mastitis that the growth hormone causes.
Mm.
I mean, this is the pharmaceutical farm.
Yeah.
This is the degree of drug addiction that our modern meat and dairy industries have become, and it's. I even sometimes wonder when I look at our human population and how much drug use and addiction we have, and how many people are suffering from this. You know, how much of that is due to our eating foods that are produced with drugs. I mean, we are a drug-infused culture. We take drugs for granted. There's a pill for every ill. We think of drugs as the equivalent of medicine, when really healing starts with prevention. It doesn't start with taking a drug. It starts with eating well. And we don't do that. We don't think about that. We eat poorly and then think, well, the doctor will prescribe a drug. We self-medicate with recreational drugs to make ourselves feel better and to make ourselves capable of staying on the treadmill that we're racing on to oblivion. I mean, there's so many ways that we're out of balance. And our disconnect from animals is part of that. And if we could restore ourselves to a respectful relationship to our bodies, to our food supply, to the earth, to the other animals that are part of this earth community with us, who draw breath from the same source as we do, we would be doing something to end this alienation and restore ourselves to our harmony and our connection with our spirits and our health and one another.
It is such a joy to have John Robbins on today's program. He's internationally known activist, best-selling author. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of Diet for a New America. It's a book you must read for you and your family. We'll have much more of this conversation right after this short break. John Robbins is my guest today. We're talking about his groundbreaking book. It's celebrating its 25th anniversary, Diet for a New America. John, I wanted to ask you very quickly, can you talk for a moment about how cows were revered in days past when society moved at a slower pace?
Well, an example of that is the Hindu culture in India. And we hear about the phrase, the sacred cow. Well, there was this sense in traditional Hindu culture that cows were treated with reverence. Now, I don't know about sacred cow. I don't know if they were. They certainly weren't perceived as holy, but they were perceived as having value onto themselves. That their life force, their nature, was an inherently good thing and part of this earth and part of our hearts and part of our lives. Not something to exploit, in other words. Not something here for us to dominate and use however we see fit and for whatever purpose we might want, but something worthy of our respect. And in that, there's it's a different relationship to the natural world. You know, in our we see a forest and we start measuring board feet. You know, we want to conquer it and convert it into revenue. We have a relationship to the natural world that is predatory, frankly. And we're using it for our purposes. We're taking without giving back. And we are undermining the life support systems of this planet upon which our economy and upon which our lives, in fact, depend. And that relationship of dominator, that relationship of predator, that relationship of conqueror, is part of our illness. And it's something that if we could heal it, it would restore us, and I think that looking at our relationship to animals, and looking at our food supply, and whether it's coming from a system that's based in domination and conquering and exploiting, or whether it's coming from a system that is in harmony with the earth, and the earth creatures, and with other cultures and other people. It's a tremendously important question. And it's one of the reasons I am a fan of and advocate of organic food.
Mm-hmm.
Because pesticide-based agriculture, not only do we poison ourselves with residues of these poisons, but we poison the farm workers. We poison the soil. We poison the other animals that depend on clean water. We poison the water table, and we poison the microorganisms that make soil fertile. Growing our food with poisons is a bad idea, frankly, and it's part of the insanity that where we try to take as much as we can, as quickly as we can, without heeding the longer-term implications.
And there's so much misunderstanding. In the second section of your book, John, you talk about perceived versus actual dietary needs. You say conventional wisdom has it that animal products constitute two of the four basic food groups and are essential for human health, but the most righteous, solid, and careful nutritional research on the effects of diet styles on human health points in a decidedly different direction. Some of the information you share about dietary needs is startling, especially about life expectancy. So let's start with that. Can you talk a bit about the life expectancy statistics and how they've changed over the years and why?
Well, vegetarians live longer. That's what the data show. People who derive their nutrients from plants, and that includes their protein as well as their fats and carbohydrates, their vitamins and antioxidants and phytochemicals and all the nutrients that your body needs to optimally function. The higher percentage of those you get from whole food, plant foods and from plants, the longer you'll live, the less likely you are to have cancer, the less likely you are to have heart disease, the less likely you are to be overweight or have diabetes. In fact, the longer your health span will be, which is a critical distinction. I mentioned this earlier. Lifespan is important. All of us want to live long lives. But health span may be even more important.
Yeah.
Because
that's the quality of life.
That's the quality of life. You know, over half of our people who are 85 years of age and above in this country today have dementia, most often Alzheimer's disease, but other forms of dementia as well. This is really sad. Over half. Ironically, it's also true that for people who've eaten healthy diets, when they reach those ages, and they often do, they don't have dementia. They have far less of it. I can't say they have none, but instead of it being over 50%, it's more like 10%. And this is a major improvement. Cognitive loss in elder years is not fun for anybody. It's certainly not fun for the family that has to take care of the person.
What you share about protein needs is fascinating. I was especially surprised at the chart you have on page 156, I actually have it in front of me right now, that shows the amount of protein that's in such vegetables as spinach. So many people think, John, that in order to obtain adequate amounts of protein, animal products must be a dietary staple. Clearly, you've debunked that myth. Can you talk about how it's possible to get all the protein one needs from simply eating vegetables and grains and such?
Well, if your diet has a lot of junk food in it, a lot of sugar, a lot of bad fats, a lot of empty calories, then you may need meat to get enough protein.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're eating good foods, wholesome foods, natural foods, plant foods, you will get enough protein no matter what plants you eat, unless you're eating junk food, which provide none. So that's the secret. Just eat good food, and you don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to keep a slide rule in your kitchen. Frances Bourlepay, a dear friend of mine, her friends call her Frankie, wrote a book called Diet for a Small Planet that was very popular some years back, and it brought to the public the idea that you could get enough protein on a vegetarian diet, but you had to be very careful about it. You had to combine your proteins, so you got legumes and grains and so forth, in particular orders. And then, did you know, when she wrote the 10th anniversary edition of Diet for a Small Planet, she recanted. She said, well, it turns out I was wrong. She says, you don't really have to worry about it. If you're eating wholesome, natural plant foods, you will get enough protein no matter what you eat. You really don't have to worry about it. We have become so afraid of not getting enough protein, and that fear has been inculcated in us by the beef industry for the most part, mm-hmm. because it sells their product. They want us afraid. They want us to think that we have to eat their product, what they're marketing, what they're selling, in order to not be deficient. That's not true. And in fact, the medical studies are overwhelming that the people who derive the majority or all of their protein from plant sources live longer, healthier lives.
Yeah, and a lot of the misinformation we pick up, if we're not careful, we just pass it on from one generation to the next.
We do. And there's an industry profiting from our doing so.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a joy to have John Robbins on today's program. Always learn more information from this beautiful soul. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary edition of his groundbreaking book, Diet for a New America. We'll have much more, but first, a word from our sponsor.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. It's a joy to have John Robbins on today. We're talking about Diet for a New America, the 25th anniversary edition. John, let's talk about the cancer war, and that's the term that often people use in advertising. You talk a lot in this chapter about the risks of colon cancer and how it can be directly correlated to fat consumption. This risk is increased in meat eaters because of the fat content. Can you please talk about how we can prevent this by simply educating people on the detrimental side effects of meat and fat consumption?
Well, there was a very large study that was done headed by Walter Willett of the Harvard Medical School. And at the end of it, he concluded that the optimum amount of red meat that you should eat if you're concerned about colon cancer is zero. There are many reasons for this, but the data implicating beef consumption, particularly with colon cancer and other digestive ills, irritable bowel syndrome, spastic colon, constipation, bloating. There's many, many kinds of abdominal distress that are correlated to beef consumption, to animal fat consumption, and even to animal protein consumption. A natural plant-strong diet has enough fiber in it, has enough nutrients in it, doesn't have the bad fats in it, and will give you a healthy digestive tract. It will give you the movement that you want, the fluidity that you want, the ease that you want in your system so that you feel better, you're happier, and you're not keeping food in your colon too long where the poisons can become toxic into your body.
Mm-hmm. There's a powerful chapter you wrote called America the Poisoned. Your section on the food chain in this chapter is quite alarming, yet so obvious when one really stops to think about it. Yet the problem I think we face as a society is that we're not stopping to think about this at all. Can you talk about the food chain and detail how toxins and pesticides are passed through the foods we eat?
Well, when you eat higher on the food chain, you are subjecting yourself to higher concentrations of the toxic chemicals, and these include pesticides of all types, mm-hmm. that have been, that are now extant in our industrial agriculture. We've used so many of these things that we think it's normal, But our bodies don't think it's normal. Our bodies react to them with illness. These chemicals are neurotoxic. They cause cancer. They cause birth defects. They cause autoimmune diseases. They wreak havoc on our hormonal balances, leading to all kinds of endocrine disruptions, leading to all kinds of sexual difficulties. These chemicals are really a bane to our lives. And yet we think of it as normal to ingest them. And whenever we eat higher on the food chain, and that means eating meats and dairy products and eggs, eating animals instead of plants, we subject our bodies to higher collections and concentrations of these poisons. We really need to eat a healthier way of life, to find a healthier way of life by eating closer to the earth, which is where our natures are.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we have evolved to eat.
Yeah.
People talk about us having descended from hunter-gatherers. Well, the evidence is actually that we descended from gatherer-hunters.
Mm.
Yes, some meat here and there when it was available, but the bulk of our diet was plants, and certainly not Twinkies.
Which I hear can last an eternity.
Yeah. Yeah. So, do you know why they call it Wonder Bread?
No.
Because it's a wonder if you're still alive if you've eaten it.
Cue the snare drum.
Yeah.
Your last chapter, I believe, is All Things Are Connected. I love the title of that because it reminded me of Reverence for Life. And at the beginning of this chapter, you give a quote from one of my all-time favorite musicians, John Denver, that just sums it up. And the quote was, "Love is feeding everybody." Then you then talk about the waste that we create and produce and how not only do we waste huge amounts of food that could feed those who are starving, but we also pollute that which is left. Can you talk about this, please?
Well, John Denver was a close friend of mine, and he was on the board of Earth Save, the nonprofit I founded, and I miss him. And I think a lot of us miss his music. Those of us who are fortunate to know him personally,
mm-hmm.
Miss him even more. He was a wonderful man, a great artist, of course, but also a really fine human, loving human being. And he understood, as many of us do, that human hunger is really a crime against all of us. It's something we should really resolve. To be fully human, we must. And yet, we feed most of our grain to livestock. If the people of the United States ate 10% less beef, and I don't think that's asking too much by any means. I think that's eminently doable, 10% less beef. We would save enough grain to feed 60 million people.
Mm.
And that is the number of people expected to die of hunger and hunger-caused disease on this planet this year. Now, I'm not saying that all we have to do to eliminate world hunger is to eat less beef, because there is no guarantee whatsoever that the grain we would save would in fact reach the world's hungry. They are the world's poor. They can't afford to buy it. There are huge economic issues here.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a guarantee. Not an ounce of that grain will reach the world's hungry if we consume it ourselves, in effect, by cycling it through the livestock whose flesh we eat. Meat production is wasteful. Feedlot beef production is extremely wasteful. It's a terribly inefficient use of grain and a terribly inefficient use of the land and the water and the human labor and the energy and all the food resources that went into the production of that grain. If those resources could be used otherwise and used to benefit the world's hungry, we could finally say we're human beings. We could finally live with reverence for life. We could finally find our hearts expressed in the way that we are in the world.
And John, in just a quick minute, in the 25 years or so since this book first came out, are you more hopeful now for society and our changes, dietary changes?
Oh, I don't know, Richard. I am both more and less hopeful. I suppose there's a lot of suffering in this world, but there is also a lot of overcoming of suffering. And I think we can still find it in ourselves to restore our lives to harmony and to restore our connections to the earth and to each other. But it's going to take an act of will to do it. It's going to take a real understanding that if we don't, we're going to end up, I'm terribly afraid, where we are headed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, John, can you share your website for people to learn more about
yes,
you and the work you're doing?
The best one actually is foodrevolution.org, foodrevolution.org. And I'm the co-founder with my son, Ocean, of a now a 90,000-member network, the Food Revolution Network. It's free to join. There's a lot of resources there. And again, foodrevolution.org.
Yeah, and I'm a part of that as well. I appreciate the emails that are going out. It's a lovely website. And John Robbins, thank you so much for the work that you continue to do in this world. It's been an honor to have you on today's broadcast.
Thank you, Richard.
Once again, John's website is foodrevolution.org. John writes towards the end of his book, "But once we become aware of the impact of our food choices, we can never really forget. Of course, we can push it all to the back of our minds, and we may need to do this at times to endure the enormity of what is involved. But the earth itself will remind us, as will our children and the animals and the forests and the sky and the rivers, that we are part of this earth, and it is a part of us. All things are deeply connected. And so the choices we make in our daily lives have enormous influence, not only on our own health and vitality, but also on the lives of other beings, and indeed on the destiny of life on Earth." We'll have more, but first, here's a song from one of our Serendipity Festival performers. The artist is Wa. Thank you. With more words from John Robbins. This is actually a dream he shares in the very beginning of this wonderful book, Diet for a New America. John writes, I have a dream. I see humankind understanding that the spirit that sings in our hearts sings as well in the hearts of other animals. I see us realizing that there are many kinds of intelligence, many kinds of souls, many kinds of suffering and striving. I see us knowing that all creatures are endowed with the same will to live that we possess. I see us respecting theirs as we would like our own to be respected, were we in the less powerful position and they dominant upon the earth. I see us grateful for these extraordinary companions. I see our lives rich with animals. I see us with many animal friends. I see our cities sprinkled with wild places, shorelines, parks, ravines, and creek canyons where wild creatures can live. I see all life forms working together in harmony, cultivating the full potential of the planet. I see us appreciating the different needs, different kinds of intelligence, and different responsibilities of the various animals. I see us sensing the unique ways in which they feel, they think, they suffer, and they love. I also see us learning to treat with respect those who are, in the greater scheme of things, but our younger brothers and sisters. I see us realizing they too are expressions in their individual ways of the universal life force. I see us acting from the knowledge that is the same God force that gives us all breath. I see us realizing that all God's critters have a place in the choir. I want to thank John Robbins for sharing his time with us today, and I want to thank you for sharing your time with us by tuning in. This has been a Journeys Fire production. Our website is richardbrendan.org. And so for engineer Joe Bainline and production coordinator Monica Tennell, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.